You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Only three people living today know what it's really like to be president, but Vanity Fair contributing editor Michael Lewis at least had a much better idea now than he had a few years ago. He was granted rare access to the president over the course of 6 months, and he writes about what he saw of President Obama's life and work in his article, Obama's Way, which appears in the October issue of Vanity Fair. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Lewis back to our show today. Hello.
How are you doing?
Your most recent book, Boomerang Travels in the New Third World, is just out in paperback from Norton. It's on a totally different topic. How did you go from that to this?
When I finished with the European debt crisis as a subject, I had on my plate the screenplay of Liar's Poker, my first book. And I knew I wasn't going to have time to write a book, but I had time for a magazine piece. And I thought, what do I really want to do? If I had got 6 months, what do I want to do? And I've always, for the longest time, I've wanted to reprise a piece of journalism that was in The New Yorker in the 1950s. John Hersey did a long series on Harry Truman. And Truman let him in to basically walk in his shoes. And I'd asked Clinton, back when Clinton was president, I asked the Clinton White House if they would let me do this, and they kind of flirted with me a bit, and they went away. So I sent this more or less the same email to the Obama White House.
Well, we've seen Bob Woodward gain access, not this sort.
No,
and of course, I'm sure they thought you might be a lot kinder than he would have been.
Well, I don't, you know, that's not obvious to me, because if they, to the extent that they would have gone and looked at my paper trail, they would have discovered that I've had kind of one close association with a politician, and it was John McCain, and that I actually kind of became pals with John McCain. So I think they would have had a hard time reading me politically going in. The kind of access I required was so different from what Woodward asked. I mean, what Woodward will ask for, and most don't, is can I sit down with the president for an hour and ask him questions? What I wanted to do was hang out with him. I wanted to just follow him around. I needed to loiter in his vicinity for a long periods of time and see him do what he did.
Well, what did you think the modern presidency was like before you started working on this article?
I hadn't really thought about it all that much. It did seem to me that there was this kind of reality distortion field around it, and that it must look different to the person who's sitting in the office than it does to the, if you're just doing nothing but watching cable news. And among other things, it always strikes me how quick the whole world is to second guess whatever any president does, because you know that the president is operating with better information than the outside world. There's kind of this bleacher bum culture around the presidency. So I imagine that there would be a story. I just didn't know what it was.
Well, that better information can cut both ways, obviously, as we saw in the lead up to the war in Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction. Many people thought the president knew a lot more than we did. It turned out that either he didn't or he...
That's a case. Now, there's a problem. This is a different thing. The president has access to state-of-the-art information. Now, it may be that the information is no better than what you got in the newspapers, no worse. But you are surrounded by people sometimes who want to bring their biases into your life and who are presenting you with a slanted view of things. That was the case of the intelligence leading into the Iraq war.
You were allowed to see the president inside the bubble. How powerful is the bubble?
It's incredible. It operates in a number of different ways. I mean, he hates it. Quite clearly.
He finds it frustrating?
He's not a typical politician. I mean, he had a whole life before he became a political person. And, you know, he wasn't the kind of person who was running for junior class president when he was in high school. He's a very odd person to have ended up in this office. I mean, I think in some ways it's stranger that we have someone who is so interested in authenticity as president than it is to have a black man as president. I mean, it's more flukish. But let's tell it through his eyes that you walk in from the moment you're elected, your house is a garrison. From the moment you're elected, you can't go anywhere without a press pool that follows you, and they follow you to the most trivial events, your ceremonies at your kid's school, not because they actually think it's going to be interesting, but because they think there's an outside chance you might get shot. So you have a death watch around you all the time.
You also might say something inappropriate, and they'll catch it on film. When you asked him, what would you do if you could have a normal day, he didn't have to even wait a moment to come up with an answer.
Now, I structured our interactions as kind of games. And one of the games I played with him was, I grant you a day when you're no longer, when nobody knows you anymore. You're back to being who you were, you know, 10 years ago, when you could have, you know, taken a White House tour and no one would have recognized you. What do you do with the day? And I thought it was going to be a challenge for him. He essentially recited a short story. It was like sitting there with books on tape. And it was this fantasy about being on a beach in Hawaii. It was the same beach his mother had walked on when she was pregnant with him, and where he used to love to go body surf. And he talked about it. He described in great detail. I couldn't get it all down, this day of body surfing. And we were on Air Force One when he was describing this. And when he was done, the plane landed, and we had to get off. And but before he got off, he turned to me, he said, and if I had a second day, you want to just keep going? And I said, it sounds like you have a list in your head. He says, I do. I have a list in my head. And my advice to you, if you're going to be president, is keep a list.
Now, why games? Is it because you knew that the president is competitive?
You know, I sensed he was competitive. I didn't really know he
was
competitive.
Well, you found out you were playing basketball.
When I did everything with him, he's got a competitive streak. But it wasn't so much that. It's sort of like, how do you get to know somebody? The best way to get to know somebody is not to sit there and talk to them. It's to do things with them. And things are revealed about character in doing things. And so he would have the natural chunk of free time, unexpected free time he would have would be, you know, 40 minutes or 30 minutes. What are you going to do with that? Am I going to sit and grill him about Medicare policy? It could be tedious. And you're not going to really actually learn anything about him. You're going to get a speech about Medicare. So what I did instead was say, all right, with this 30 minutes, let's pretend in 30 minutes you're not going to be president. I'm going to be president. Teach me how to be president. Or let's pretend you have days when you aren't, no one knows who you are. What are you going to do? Or let me do your morning commute with you. Let's commute together one day. And he entered into the spirit of the thing, and it was totally useful. It was a way of just kind of a list teasing out of him things that maybe hadn't been teased before.
But did you have a sense that he'd, obviously when you asked him that other question and he started telling you a whole story, he had obviously thought about it.
I was surprised he had thought about it so much.
But these other things as well? Or is he just very quick to respond?
Oh, no, this was a particular prompt response. So when I asked him, the first time I asked him, told him, you're not president, I'm president. How do you teach me how to be president? It took him the whole 30 minutes to get his mind around the idea I was president. He kept refusing, basically, to enter into the spirit of the game. He kept being president. And I kept saying, no, you don't understand. I'm the president. And he'd say, no. He wouldn't say no, but he'd get kind of this look on his face like, that's just weird. You're not the president. You're not going to be the president. So I came back at him two or three times, and he finally kind of got into the spirit of the thing.
I wonder what would happen if Mitt Romney asked him that question. So you start by describing his basketball game. Did you see something about him there that was different from what you saw him like elsewhere?
So all kinds of things. I play occasionally in a pickup basketball game, and I play with people I don't really know very well, but I know them in a weird way very well because of how they play basketball. And so what I discovered was, one, the kind of game he likes to play in. He didn't warn me. He should have warned me. I thought it was a normal kind of 50-year-old guy pickup basketball game. He plays, when he plays, it's not that often, every couple months. He inserts himself into a game, a regular game in Washington that plays three or four times a week. And most of the guys are in their late 20s, kind of early 30s. All of them played major college basketball. Most of them played professionally. And it looks like a really good college basketball game is what it looks like.
So he's the worst player on the court.
He is the worst player on the court, but it takes a while to see that. He's good enough so that he doesn't stick out, and he picks his spots. So nobody defers to him. That's the second interesting thing, that he's playing with all these people, and The opposition exploits him to the extent it can exploit him. He wears a mouth guard when he plays. He was demanding his mouth guard before we went to play this time because he said, as he said, just casually, "I don't want to get my teeth knocked out this time." I said, "We're playing basketball. You're going to get your teeth knocked out?" He started showing me teeth that had been knocked out. And he says, "We got an election coming up, and I can't have no teeth." They don't. He took. We played six games.
Well, and you joined in.
I played.
You ever think that there would come a day when the president of the United States would be yelling at you to play defense better?
Well, he was really screaming at me. I was so irritated in a way that he had let me get into this game without warning me, that in the beginning I just kind of jacked up a couple of shots. I was on his team, and he started screaming at me. He let me know that we weren't going to lose because of me. Actually, what he did in the first place is we rolled into the FBI gym, and he kind of looked at me shooting around on the side, and he said, "You know, we'll just let you sit a little while and on the bench until we get a lead." And I thought he was kidding, but he wasn't kidding. He benched me. I started by being benched. But he's – so the last – I'd say the other thing about – you notice about him, and I think this is actually a big deal, that he wants to play in a game where people do not defer to him. Where everybody's just guys. He really wants that. And one of the players said to me, I said, "If you do anything to suggest he's the president, if you change your game in any way, you'll find you're not invited to play in this game." I think that's a very interesting character trait.
Michael Lewis's article in the current issue of Vanity Fair is called Obama's Way. What impressed you most about the environment he works in and the way he operates in that environment? There are lots of everyday details about his life that you report, what he wears and how his clothes are chosen, his typical daily schedule, what he reads. Does that help give us a window into how he formulates his policies or his decision-making process?
So you asked me what interested me most about this environment, and my mind is going to that. I will answer that first. And I only kind of scratch at this in the piece. And I would like to scratch more. One of the things that's really striking about the job is the emotional roller coaster that is any given day. On any given day, virtually every given day, you will, for example, sit down with the parents of a kid who's just been killed in Afghanistan, spend half an hour with a Make-A-Wish child who's going to die in 3 weeks, engage in various trivial ceremonial functions like handing Super Bowl trophies to Super Bowl players, listen to people say lots of rude things about you, many of which are just inventions, but some of which may sting, negotiate with the opposition, sit and listen to and try to get your mind around really complicated subjects and get to the nub of it. You bounce. You kind of leap between these emotional emotions. It's kind of like jumping over ravines. And it's not natural to do that. If you sit down with the parents of a kid who's just been killed in Afghanistan, you would spend the rest of your day, a normal person would spend the rest of their day infected by that experience. How he contains that and how a person in that job has to contain that at the same time that any crisis anywhere in the world, most of which you have nothing to do with, is coming in on you for you to respond to, I find that riveting. And I talked to him at length about this. It was the most interesting dimension to the job, and one if I went back, I'd want to explore more.
Well, obviously, the president is a victim of events to a large degree. And how much of his time is devoted to being preventive as opposed to being responsive?
So this is a great question, right? Because we're in the middle of a presidential campaign, and the conceit is sort of you control the world when you're president. So we're going to elect this person because he's going to control the world in this way. And he gives us his platform. He gives us his ideas. And then reality happens, which is chaos, fog of war, an opposition that won't cooperate or, in fact, will obstruct whatever you want to do. The mere fact that you want to do it causes them to be against it. That opposition domestically for Obama is called the Republicans. In foreign affairs, it's called the Russians.
And then he also has issues with his own party at times.
Exactly. So when I'm playing this game with him, how to be president, it becomes clear to me that some large part of the job is purely reactive. It's sort of deciding not just how you react, but what you're going to react to or whether to react at all. And this isn't in the piece, but it was interesting to me. I said to him at one point, you know, as president, you spend a lot of time stating the obvious, having to repeat yourself ad nauseum, and people still don't hear what you said. It just strikes me that the job requires you to do a lot of things that don't come naturally to an intelligent person. He kind of laughed. He didn't add on to it, but he kind of laughed. And he said it didn't come naturally to me to get up and say something that seemed just totally obvious. And it took him a while to realize that he had almost an obligation to respond to things, even if he had nothing to add to them. So sit at any given day, if you look at the newspaper, you realize there's always something there, and often many things, that the president has had to participate in that came out of nowhere. So it is a very reactive job. And in judging a person for the job, I would judge not just their plan, but also the kind of capacity to react, the spirit in which they react to things, their character.
My guest is Michael Lewis. His latest piece for Vanity Fair is called Obama's Way. It's in the October issue. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Michael Lewis, and he's written an article called Obama's Way for the October issue of Vanity Fair, in which he relates what it was like to spend 6 months with President Obama every day, or how much?
No. So this starts in January and ends in mid-August, so it's more than 6 months, and I flew in and out of his life 8 or 9 times, and I'd either go to the White House or I would take off on Air Force One on trips.
You described the meetings around the president's decision to get involved in Libya after Muammar Gaddafi's threats to kill many of the people in the city of Benghazi. Why were those conversations so unusual? Isn't that what presidents do?
Well, I thought, given that so much of this job was about decision-making and how much effort he had gone to create an environment to maximize his ability to make good decisions and understanding, and he thinks very probabilistically, which is not useful in a weird way for a president, in that I think people want their leaders to seem like they're totally certain about everything. An intelligent person in an office would realize that every decision that comes across my desk, there's a 45% chance no matter what I do, it's going to go wrong. That you shouldn't be certain. You should be kind of dubious about everything. But given he was so aware of that, I just wanted to describe a single decision. And the foreign policy stuff was the most interesting place to go because it was where you could see his fingerprints. It was where he had the most latitude, where he wasn't obstructed by the opposition instantly.
The way we imagine those things is that the president gathers around a lot of advisors. They all present their opinions, and then the president chooses which one he thinks will work best. But he wasn't satisfied with any of the options.
No, that
was
made this so much more interesting. So let's frame this for the audience. He is sitting there in March of last year, and Gaddafi is marching across the desert in Libya, and having said that he's going to basically exterminate a city full of rats, he calls them. And they're basically a million people in this city. So what is about to happen is probably a genocide. Don't know for sure, but that's the likely outcome. The French and the British have proposed creating a no-fly zone over Libya. And the French are going to introduce it as a UN resolution, try to get a UN resolution to establish a no-fly zone over Libya. Obama convenes a meeting in the White House in the Situation Room to discuss what to do. The Pentagon's job was to come and give him his options. And at this meeting are Biden, his chief of staff, Bill Daley, Hillary Clinton's there by satellite, so on and so forth. A lot of important people are there, 18 people are there. And the Pentagon says, there are two options: do nothing at all, or join in the no-fly zone. And Obama asks, "Well, if we establish a no-fly zone, will this solve the problem? Will it stop him from killing these people?" And they say, oh, no, he's not flying. He's marching across the desert in tanks. So it won't actually affect the outcome. And Obama said, why are we even having the meeting? You didn't even give me an option to consider that would solve the problem. So he went outside the box. And as he said, you know, the process is designed to give a president a yes or no, a box to tick. And he thought his role in the process should be to override the process. And that's what he did in this case. So he said to the Pentagon, I've got a ceremonial dinner to attend. Go off. I'll see you in 2 hours. Give me an option. And then what happens is interesting to me on a number of levels. So they come back and they say, well, there is a third option. You have your first two options. And box number three is now we can go in with our air power and we can destroy Gaddafi on the ground. They clearly don't want to do this. They don't want to do this because we're entangled in Iraq. We're in Afghanistan. We're stretched. Politically, his advisors, Daley, Biden, say this is crazy. Basically, there's no upside to going in. Just bad things are going to happen. The politics are horrible. The American people aren't obviously for this. We shouldn't do it. The national security people are, there's no national core national security interest in preventing a genocide. He asks at that point to hear the views of the junior people around the wall, around the room, who would normally be solicited for their views. And a number of those people have, one way or another, an intimate connection to the genocide in Rwanda, that they were scarred by it in some way. And they speak for going in. Obama finally decides. He makes the decision, and the decision is we're gonna go in. But it's done in such a way that it's not divisive. It's interesting that it wasn't divisive. This sort of thing happens with a different person in charge. You could see how it would result in a dozen Bob Woodward books about how the administration is split. You know, so the senior people weren't for it. There was no constituency for his decision. The junior people were for it, but what he did to assuage the fears of his senior people was he required the French and the British to take ownership, so that if we would go in, do what we could do well, and they had to own the mess if there was a mess, kind of thing.
My guest is Michael Lewis. His article, Obama's Way, is in the October issue of Vanity Fair. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Since you observed that, are you surprised that he hasn't taken a similar tack in Syria? Because we are seeing the equivalent of a genocide there as well.
No. And I tell you why. Because, and this is where I think he gets to be his most interesting, in that so this Libyan decision has been regarded as a huge success. It worked, you know, it was a foreign policy success. So it didn't get that much attention because there wasn't a whole big market for trumpeting that success. I think most people, when they have successes, they start to construct a narrative about how it was inevitable that they would decide this way and it would go this way. Of course I did that kind of thing. I'm a smart guy. Obama, when you talk to him about that decision, he still thinks of it as a 51-49 decision. He could very easily not have done it if the American military was going to be more exposed to harm, if the politics on the ground were slightly different. There were all these conditions. It wasn't just between a just war and an unjust war. It was a smart war versus a dumb war. And so you could see how if the situation was slightly different, he would have come to a different decision. And this is the last point. And the last point is, think about this. Think about the godlike powers of this office. 1 million people in a desert in Libya waiting to find out whether they're going to live or die. And the president, who has the sole power really on the planet to save their lives at that point, is thinking of it as a close-run thing.
Except that it's still a tenuous situation. Yesterday, the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens, and three colleagues were killed by a mob in Benghazi when they attacked the consulate there in anger over a film that was made by someone in California that denigrated the Prophet Muhammad. In his statement from the White House this morning, President Obama talked about how yesterday's deaths didn't affect the U.S.'s commitment to Libya. Is that a continuation of the string of decisions in March 2011 that you describe here?
Yeah, it's hard to see how this in any way informs an understanding of what he did then. Because what the Libyan government has condemned what's happened in Libya. You've got a dozen guys throwing bombs at an American consulate. And it's not, this isn't the government that's coming after it. The government's going to bring these people to justice. This sort of disgusting behavior, it seems to me, is more likely if we allow the million people in Benghazi to be exterminated. So it's kind of hard to say that our intervention in Libya encouraged extremism. That doesn't compute to me.
Throughout the article, you tell the story of U.S. Air Force Captain Tyler Stark. Why was he important to explaining what life is like inside the White House?
I thought it was when you're inside the White House and making these decisions, they are abstract. They're abstract from the people they're affecting. And I thought it was important to include someone real who was on the other end of the string from the president's decision, who was connected to the president's mind, and so whose life was upended because of a president's character. And this person happened to be the navigator on the F-15 that went down over Libya in the first days of bombing Gaddafi's troops. And his name is Tyler Stark. And he was also at the same time a little metaphor for what can go wrong in presidential decision-making, that the president instantly realized when he hears that a plane is down that this is a new narrative waiting to happen, that the minute an American comes to harm or comes to grief in what he's doing, that this can be reinterpreted as a failure and something we shouldn't have done.
Well, there was a symbolic aspect to going into Libya, and symbolism seems to really play a major role in the way we even view the president. The president set off a controversy when he switched out a bust of Winston Churchill that President Bush had kept in the Oval Office for one Martin Luther King Jr.'s. That could have been seen as something totally innocent. There was a second Winston Churchill bust in the White
House. He had two of the same bust, that's right. And the one
he's come under incredible criticism for that.
Imagine how much trouble it's going to be for the guy who follows him to remove the Martin Luther King bust. I mean, that each president, the White House itself is a metaphor, that it is increasingly ossified. It's increasingly difficult to change anything about it. At one point, Obama showed me a patio that Reagan had built off the back of his private office, and he kind of laughed. He said, "You imagine what would happen if I did that?"
There was a hole in the
But this is the other thing.
There's the White House lawn.
That's right. So the symbols of the White House, people respond to that, but the reality is something completely different. The whole the Churchill bust controversy flared up while I was working on the piece, and I noticed that. The whole time I was working on the piece, the 8 months I was going in and out of the White House, there was this crater on the front of the White House lawn, and there were all these workmen, many stories below, building something, and no one asked questions about it. It was out of sight, kind of thing. And who knows what he's putting down there? A bunker? They would say infrastructure when you ask them, but basically they said we can't talk about it. But this was something massive, and yet it was completely off the radar. And it was sort of like there are things that happen to which the American public are totally blind. They just don't. They can be very, very important things, but they're totally blind. And there are things that happen that the American public will obsess about that are actually trivial. And part of being president is figuring out which is which.
Your last book, Boomerang, was about the impact of the financial crisis in Europe. It's just out in paperback with the new afterword, in which you write, a lot has happened, and yet, given the provocation, it's amazing how little has happened. Now, is this just an American situation, or are people in Europe more likely to respond actively to a situation? In this country, the president's been criticized, for example, for not going after many of the people who created the financial crisis.
I think this is a very slow boiling but profound story, this debt crisis. And it's and what we see of it in the newspapers is the noise, the froth on top from policy elites who are trying to contain the problem. the way they are dealing with the problem is profoundly anti-democratic. They're not letting the people, they're trying to kind of keep the people out of the conversation.
Especially in Europe, where they get together, they seem to have a meeting and then a little bit is done, but mostly it's a lot of talk.
You know, yesterday there were 2 million people on the streets of Barcelona agitating for Catalonia to separate from Spain. The place is pulling apart. That is what's happening, into haves and have-nots, successes and failures. The rich do not want to subsidize the poor. The successes don't want to subsidize the failures. The countries that are the failures don't want to live with the austerity that is being imposed on them by the successes. This is ultimately going to play itself out in the voting booths of Europe. I mean, it is going to be a matter of public opinion, and I think the way they're handling it, to sort of string it out, the way they're stringing it out, it's sort of exacerbating the problem. It's allowing anger to build over a very long period of time. And I think, at the moment, it's pointing towards increasingly uglier endings. But it's a long story.
Just a couple more things, because we're pretty much out of time. The president was praised for his speeches when he was campaigning. As a president, he's been criticized by some for not communicating more clearly. What did he say about his speeches and how he writes them?
So this was actually the first thing I wanted to talk to him about when I went in January, because there's a school of thought that says that the real power of the presidency is the power of the bully pulpit. It was a book that was written about it, a famous book, Richard Neustadt, a Harvard political scientist. And I thought how strange it was that this man who was so celebrated for his eloquence is all of a sudden accused of not being able to communicate. It seemed, it's a curious situation. And his response to it in a nutshell was, yeah, maybe I'm partly to blame for the way I've communicated. I told a story in the campaign, and it's harder to tell a story as president. But he basically said the bully pulpit's broken. That the office is not what it was as a communications tool. It's harder and harder to get through to the American people. He said there were many examples he offered about how times where he had repeated himself 150 times only to hear that he'd never said that before. And I think it's really true that we listen differently to someone who's campaigning than we do to a president. And the communications machinery is just broken.
Now, you had to get quote approval here. How much did he change it to craft better speeches?
So the one thing I allowed them to do, because they were doing it with all journalists, is I said that they're going to let me loiter like this and sort of be a fly on the wall. They get a right to see what he's saying in the piece, the quotes, the direct quotes, nothing else. And he changed. He apparently read them himself. Changed almost nothing. I mean, I'd already written the piece. I had to do nothing to it, so it was trivial.
Well, they took out a thing about him tearing up. I guess that's the Edmund Muskie rule. Although John Boehner,
but he didn't
still allowed to tear up.
Yeah, no, that was a little different. It wasn't him. It was he wasn't that sensitive to that. But in any case, if I gave them 6 pages of quotes, there were 3 or 4 things on it that bothered them, and I didn't even understand why they bothered them.
Michael Lewis's article, Obama's Way, is in the October issue of Vanity Fair. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.